when we started like organizing the company, it was sometimes helpful to know, you know, where people are working, and this is where like the org chart comes up. And I didn't necessarily like making org charts, but one way I thought that was really interesting is when I looked at the org chart, usually you're seeing people's skills put into buckets. So they work in like development or design, and that's basically their skill, and they sit over there in the org chart. I started to break it down by person based on, here's what I know that they're really, really good at and what they like to do. And here's a bunch of stuff that's in this job that's still kind of in their way. So when I look at the org chart now, I see the names, but and then I see what's their superpower under that and what's currently in the way of that. And every person has that. And so my job as a major recruiter in the company is to figure out, can we pull out, can I get rid of this stuff that's in your way so you can just be doing your superpower?
Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. Today's conversation is with Mikkel Cho. He's the co-founder and CEO of Unsplash. They're the world's leading image asset platform that boasts 100 million image downloads and 20 billion views per month. That's more than Flickr, Getty, and Shutterstock combined. In this conversation, you'll learn how Mikkel built Unsplash from a series of failed experiments, how to balance experimentation with focus, how to create a growth flywheel, why good ideas are still undervalued, and why you should create a superpower org chart and how to find undiscovered talent. If you're new here, make sure you're subscribed and you've checked out last week's episode with Gagan Biani, the founder of Udemy. He built a $2 billion plus online education platform. Now let's get straight into the show. Hey, Mikkel, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
So look, man, we're in a new year. It's been a crazy, crazy 12 months for all of us. I've been really impressed by what you guys have been building at Unsplash. So we're going to go into a little bit of the background today, the story of growing that. And then we're going to go into a little bit more on the business philosophy side and kind of behind the mind. So just to kick us off, it would be great to give a little bit of a background on what Unsplash is, just from a very high level, because I've heard you describe it that you're not just a photo company, but you think of yourselves as a real estate company. So I'm curious what that means.
Yeah, and some background too, like Unsplash was an accidental company. So it started inside of another one that we had begun, and we had challenges growing it. And so we thought, what were some problems that our customers were having before they actually needed us that we could potentially solve while we built that up? And Unsplash was one of those ideas. And so what we do is all the images that are on the site, they're free to use for anybody. There's no weird licenses or anything that you have to figure out. There's not even sizes. Everything's high resolution. There's just a button, you hit download, and that's it. You have the image. The images are submitted by people from everywhere across the world. We have over 200,000 active contributors a month. We've just hit 2 million images. It took us 7 years to hit 1 million images. It took us 1 year to hit the 2 million. So that's really started to accelerate. And in terms of the image use, we do 110 million image downloads a month now, which is more than Shutterstock, Getty, and Adobe Stock combined.
For context for people who've never had to go through this process of finding images, right? Like I do this all the time. I've used Unsplash for years. I love it. The main problem is if you've got a small little blog like mine, you write out a beautiful post and then you're like, I need the perfect image. And back in the day, you'd have to go and either break the law and use stuff for free, which you weren't supposed to use, or you would use a site like Unsplash and that is like free for people to use. The other people who did this before, like Shutterstock, who's still around, obviously, they're a huge company. They would get people to pay mostly for these things, right? And how much would it just cost roughly? Like there's in a range, if you were saying an average.
Big ranges, but I think where it sort of nets out is like hundreds of dollars per image.
That's crazy, yeah.
That was built in an era of professional media buyers, professional creators, art departments, everybody understood licensing. And then 5 years later, everyone's creating, right? So, and you don't come from that background. So it's like 70% of the people who use Unsplash today have never used a stock photo site before.
Yeah, and I guess it makes sense if you're the New York Times, you know, and you can afford to do that. But if you're just Bilal with his little blog, he's not going to do that. So that's really interesting. And just to confirm, you know, just for context, sorry, the 2 million images, how does that compare to what else is out there in the world in terms of free and then even paid?
Yeah, so most of like the big stock photo libraries, like a Shutterstock, they got like 150 million assets. So it's tons of assets. We don't really focus on that number because that's actually the wrong way to look at it. It's like, cool, we've got a whole bunch of stuff, but 90% of it's crap. And so that's really how we looked at it at the beginning. We're going to curate everything. So we had way more images submitted. Like this is one, I think one 100th, even less, like one 200th of the images that we see coming in are the ones that get accepted and put up on the site. So there could be way more. But we really focused on quality because that was one of the problems with finding images. We just wanted to make sure that everything you saw was good.
And that's exactly why I was drawn to it, because there were a few other sites that I'd found that had free stuff.
Yeah.
But the quality on Unsplash was, I pretty much couldn't find a bad image. Like anytime I typed in any search term, it was like a 9 out of 10 or a 10 out of 10 image. So I'm actually curious about that. So is this something you guys are manually having to review to get, or are you using software to do that? Because that seems like a crazy amount of scale for, you know, a fairly small number of people to be working on this.
Yeah, so like we're a team of 24 people. When we started, I was doing the curation. We were only just one person, barely one person, because I was working on another company. I would just go in every 10 days and see what images were submitted. And we were only doing 10 images every 10 days. So it was manageable at that time. Now, yes, super complex, but we still have people who review. We have community members who are involved as well. We have members of the team. You can think of the layers of how it works. It's kind of like the Apple App Store. So there's a review that does happen, an initial one. Some of it is now automated as well. Like we are able to tell if images are submitted elsewhere on the internet before so that we can remove like fraudulent cases, that sort of thing, detecting like watermarks and that sort of stuff. But there's still people who are involved in that process. Once it's opened up, once you're on, then you increase your privileges. So once you sort of had an accepted image, you're able to do a lot more. So that's sort of the way that we've been able to have this curation, but scale at the same time. And I think we're seeing that with a lot of what you can build on the internet today, like what's most interesting to people is this combination of reaching lots of people, but with curation. Like if you compare those two, I think that's sort of this next wave.
Yeah, that's an interesting point to bring up because I feel like we went through that phase of just more is better for a long time when it wasn't actually, but we went from having 5 TV channels to YouTube, and that's an incredible growth.
Yeah.
But then now we've gone to, okay, I want someone who's an expert in this to be able to find the best stuff, or someone I trust anyway. And that's why I think even the rise of newsletters and curated content has been a big part of that as well. Thanks for that background. I don't know if you're able to share this, but whatever you're able to share on terms of sense of scale, do you share anything on revenue numbers or even profitability, anything like that, that would be helpful for people to understand?
Yeah, we don't share publicly yet, but I can give rough ballparks. This was our first year monetizing. So all the years prior, our whole business model actually was based on an advertising model. And this was largely a strategic decision. So when we looked at the evolution, I look at all these sort of marketplaces and industries, they're all evolving at different paces. And so if you break that down in just to creative industry specifically, you could say there's music, there's images, there's movies. They're all evolving in different ways and at different rates. Where images are, is there's a little bit left maybe in licensing, but not much. Like this is the one that is getting disrupted really quickly. Like the quality of the cameras, how people need to use images now has totally changed. So we've introduced an advertising model. Now to get an advertising model to work at scale, you need a lot of people seeing your images.
Yeah.
So that's why all of our first years were really focused on building the size of the audience, making sure this was really useful for people. So we do millions of dollars of revenue in our first year. That was just this one year.
And so you guys are VC backed. I think you've raised like $20 million or something like that from the last numbers I read or heard you say. But you mentioned having a company before, so I'd love to hone into that a little bit more. So I think this was Crew, right?
Yeah, we've raised 20 million total. 10 million was when we took Unsplash out, and then we spun it out and raised $10 million just for Unsplash. For Crew, we had raised roughly $10 million as well.
Got it.
And yeah, I don't know if you wanted any background on Crew, but there's a whole story.
Yeah, it'd be
there.
Actually interesting to say, because I think what's interesting with what you guys have done, it's actually, I saw some parallels with our mutual friend Jack Butcher, who was also on the show. You started doing one thing and then it led to another, and lots of people on the show have said the same. So with Jack's example, he started creating stuff for Visualize Value Online just to get a few clients for his agency.
Yeah.
For you guys, you had a main platform and Unsplash was just like an experiment on the side. So yeah, what was that main platform? And I've heard you talk about different experiments you ran and Unsplash was one of them. So what was the context of that coming together?
I moved up to Canada. I'm from the US originally. Couldn't find a job, was in Quebec and you needed to speak French. I didn't know that coming in. So starting a company or working on the internet was kind of like the options. Ended up working in an agency, started designing. That's where I started to notice these problems. And I started noticing problems in just like creativity in general. Like trying to make creative work with people was really difficult. Like I saw that at an agency. And so Crew was this way of solving that. Like, what if we could just focus on the creative work and sort of automate everything else? So I was moving to freelance, and it was like one of the biggest challenges of a freelancer is just finding good quality, consistent work. And then one of the big challenges of companies who hire freelancers is how do you make sure that you're finding good quality people? So Crew, the whole idea was to match and bring those people together. So it was a marketplace for high-end creative talent to match with good quality projects. We vetted everything. Automated like the project management, the legal, all that stuff, so you didn't have to deal with any of that crap. But that takes a long, long time to build all of that in. You're building like four or five almost separate companies that already exist if you're going to do that. And so we knew that that was going to take time. We didn't have a lot of like money to run off of in order to do that. And so we thought about, we need to figure out creative ways to bring demand that would sustain the site before we built all of this other stuff. And so we just started, we were on the phone with customers all the time because we didn't even have any of this stuff built. And that's where we started to hear a lot of the problems that they would have. So yes, they want to make, usually it was like, I want to make a website, I want to make an app. But there'd be a whole bunch of initial questions. They'd be like, how much is this roughly going to cost? Should I even make an app or should I make a website? And we actually started listening a lot to that. And we started automating that. At first, it was like templates that we would be sending by emails. And then we thought, well, this could be even something bigger. These are all these problems that our customers are saying they have before they need us. What if we created these as tools? And we looked at what a lot of companies at the time were doing, blogs, right? So that was, everybody was doing content marketing. And we're like, if we just do that, that's not going to really stand out. It's going to take us a long time to do that. What's the next level? Like, what's like content marketing on steroids? Well, we could build a tool, something that was dynamic. Because usually with a piece of content, they're telling you a story, but it's not dynamic. It's not adapting to your situation. So a very specific example is how do you price an app? You'll read a lot of blog posts. They'll tell you it's roughly between this and this if you need this. But then you don't know. You're sort of like, what's my case? So we actually made a thing that's called howmuchtomakeanapp.com. And you click through and you say, I want to make this. And then we roughly tell you the ballpark. And then we also made app first website. You know, should you build an app or a website? And walks you through those questions. And Unsplash, you know, was another thing that people were saying, like, how do we make it look good? You know, with images and all of those little problems just became opportunities for us to create marketing engines.
Yeah, I've had people describe this as like growth tools. Like their tools, like I think of Neil Patel, who's got like a big SEO blog. He creates a little piece of software that's really expensive, but for other people, and he creates a free version and it drives lots of people there and is tangential to your core audience.
Yep.
Most people don't create a side project that becomes the main thing.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess we can go into that because that's very interesting. When did you start to realize like, this thing Unsplash, well, at the time, I don't know if it was a completely separate thing. I think it was just part of your main thing, that it was, that had so much legs that you needed to kind of just focus in on that.
Just to give a sense of time scale, this was 2013. And so it was 7 years ago, and we were really working on getting that first company off the ground, so focused on it. We didn't have intentions of running something else. These were all in service of the main thing. I think there was two moments that made you rethink that philosophy. The first was that first day. So when we posted 10 images and I only put it on Hacker News because I was super embarrassed by it. It was a Tumblr blog, really nasty, like so bad. And then there was 30,000 downloads on those 10 images. I thought my expectation was 100 designers maybe would find this useful. So right there, there was sort of a moment, but I'm like, this is going to do its job. This is going to be a really good referral source for us. So we'll keep it going in that way. So I just every 10 days that first year kept doing that. But when you looked back, so after the first year, we looked back at the subscriber growth. It was a 10X and we didn't do anything. Like I spent less than an hour. And if you think comparative, the core company, we're spending all our time. Mm. And then you have this thing that you don't have to do anything. You're almost self-sabotaging it in a way. You're like less images. You're not listening to anything. You're spending no time on it, but it's pulling. And there's something that must be really special that you're hitting on there. So after that first year is when we really had that moment of, we might want to consider doing something with this. And then there was some clearer signs that happened like 6 months after that. People were using this in way other, different ways than we originally imagined. It wasn't just for websites and apps. It was expanding. And so there was some real cost that was getting associated with it. So that was another sort of moment. And that's ultimately where we decided to make the decision.
So I know that you ended up selling Crew. So like in the timeline here, where did that sale happen compared to focusing in on Unsplash? Was that before or after you'd really focused in on it?
It was right after we split the two companies. So we split the two companies. There was an amount of capital that went towards Unsplash, amount that went towards Crew. And Crew was bordering on profitability. So we thought, hey, let's get this profitable. We have the right size team. We have some partnerships that we can execute on to get us there very quickly. One of the partners said, hey, maybe we can even come up with something better where we could acquire this and combine the two. And that was Dribbble. So at the time, I didn't know because I was talking to Andrew Wilkinson, who is the founder, and he had just started acquiring companies. He had done it, but like really at scale. And I didn't even know that he had recently acquired Dribbble. It wasn't public or anything. And I called him up and said, we're thinking about this, we're talking through partnerships. And he said, well, I just bought Dribbble. What if we just combine these two? There could be something really magical between Dribbble and Crew. And so within 2 months, that deal was done as an acquisition. And then the other rest of the team went fully focused on Unsplash. So we were six and six.
So that's really interesting. So Andrew Wilkinson was actually just two episodes ago. I just recorded with him too. So worlds colliding here. I'm curious, like, how did that conversation go when it comes from being on the other side? Because I got it from Andrew on his side, what he's looking for. He's just looking for wonderful internet businesses, and yours was probably already that. So I'm curious, like, what was it like trying to negotiate a fair price and just feeling happy from both sides?
Yeah, Andrew's really clear. So the same way that the things that he's writing and speaking about, the deal went down in that same way. Mm. And we were very clear too. We said, this is what the numbers look like. This is what we're looking to do. And I think he just has a really clear multiple of what he's thinking if he's gonna acquire a company. And then also how he's gonna combine it with something else. So I think in this case, and his philosophy and thesis may have evolved since, but I think with Crew and Dribbble specifically, it was really, really clear how those two could fit together and be a, you know, 1+1=3 situation.
So let's go back onto moving on to Unsplash. So a question I have is around experimentation versus focus, right? Because this is just like, there's no one right answer, and each team and entrepreneur has to figure this out. But how did you think about finding a right balance between allowing that room for experimentation but not getting distracted, which is, I think, the downside of that?
One thing I've really learned is, when in doubt, focus. So you'll be left with those choices all the time, and I think it's like this gray area. And if you find that it's a gray area, you should choose the focus side. And that kind of helps with that mental model. If there's enough gray, if it's not like a hell yes, we should do this thing, if it's sitting in the gray area, you should probably focus. I would say I did fall in love a bit with those things because they were making huge impacts over and over and over. And it's that 0-1 is kind of fun, right? It's like creating something new and everyone's like coming towards it. People like seeing the new stuff, and you can fall in love with that a bit too much, and it can become Yeah, it can defocus you. So actually, when we went fully on Unsplash, I think I swung a little bit even the other way, like super focused. Like, we don't do pretty much anything outside our core. We really defined the core. And anything that doesn't really sit inside of that flywheel of the business, we don't really touch, unless there's like a, yeah, hell yeah moment, which we haven't had, because that core is the hell yeah. It's like, we need to be focusing right in there.
No, I love that, man. And I think my background was, I was at Google for a long time, and we had this thing called 20% projects, which a lot of people heard of. I always found them to be more like 120% projects, because you still had to do your core job. And this was always, and it ended up being more like 150% project, right? So, and I think at a scale of Google, they can still afford to do that. I think they still have that concept there. But I think it's more about giving the freedom for your employees and your team to think about it, at least. Not even to create stuff, but just having that in there means people will say, okay, cool, well, I'm doing my core job, but how can I make the company better as a whole? What are some wacky ideas that we can potentially bring to the table? And it's part of, it's really about building a culture where that's accepted. Once you got into Unsplash, you honed in and you said, okay, this is a rocket ship. We need to jump on this. What were the competitors? What was the competitive landscape at this point? Because you mentioned Adobe and Shutterstock. Like, what were they missing?
Yeah, I think there's two things. There's the, you know, how do you cannibalize yourself is one, because it's effectively what you'd be doing. Yeah. You'd be creating the thing that would eat your business. And the second is just the DNA. So the mechanics of how Unsplash works, it's not based on money. It's something that's more powerful, right? It's like, people are doing this because they want to, they feel inspired, they feel connected, they're able to create and use it as well. There's an exchange that happens. Like, we're all sort of giving a few images so that we can all use from lots of images. And I think that's a super powerful thing that's happening. And then people get their images seen by more people on Unsplash than any other place. So that's really useful in a lot of different ways. If your business is, you're able to actually get some more exposure for images that you may have just had sitting in folders. We've run numbers even comparative to like what you can get on Instagram in terms of visibility. Oftentimes it's at least a 2 to sometimes even up to a 10x of what can happen. So that's just really interesting. And from a photographer's perspective, it ends up becoming like a downstream benefit. So very similar to what blogging did. When blogging happened, a lot of people were like, oh, this is going to kill writing. You know, books are going to go away. You're going to give all your ideas for free. The opposite happened, right? People buying more books. There's more publishers, there's more writers, there's more access. And I think we're seeing that same thing. Image is just a visual story. So there's that same, component of evolution that I don't think they necessarily saw as a potential motivator for people, and didn't care about it enough from a DNA perspective.
It brings up this concept that people have been discussing recently. There was a blog post on this about the middle class of the creator economy. I don't know if you saw this or heard about it, but it kind of, if you think of like musicians, I feel like it's a really interesting example, because we went from having, you know, 20 years ago, just the really super famous people on TV, we actually buying CDs, and then we went to Napster vibe, where everyone's illegally downloading, and then we moved to real, you know, paid for streaming, but they don't make that much of streaming, and they have to make it from concerts and stuff. So I don't know the numbers, and I'm assuming there's more people in the middle that can make a living from touring if they own their masters or whatever. But how do you see this evolving similarly in what you're working on, which is photography for the moment? So for those photographers, can they make a living just from being on Unsplash, or like how does that really work from their point of view?
Yeah, if you want to be a photographer, the best way to make money today is booking work, custom work, you know, shoots, that sort of thing. And so to me, this is a relationship thing. Can you use your existing images as relationship makers? That's how we think about it. You already take images. They're probably sitting in a folder. Do something with them that will potentially create relationships. And some of these people are going to use the images for free. That's like a byproduct of it. But there's a huge order of magnitude more people now that you're going to reach because we've made that possible. So there's people going to use them for presentations and use them for different things. But they might have that specific use case. They might need to hire you. They want something. They like your work. And now they're going to hire you. And that is the real opportunity for professional photographers.
Got it. I love that. Okay. So it's like a distribution platform for them that they get their name out there more than they would have done previously.
Right. And one of the big things that we're starting to do, we have a lot of integrations. So we're built into a lot of the publishing tools. We have reverse image search stuff so we can go and figure out where things get published. And so if you're an aspiring photographer, you can add this to your book and your portfolio. You know, your images appeared in BuzzFeed. They appeared in Forbes, Fortune, which you can then leverage to book more work.
The last question I had on that section was really around your plan going in terms of monetization, because I feel like a lot of people, if you've just stumbled into something that was an experiment, you might not have a big master plan. But yeah, I'm curious. I don't want to assume that was the case. So did you have an idea of monetization from day one? Once you started focusing in on Unsplash, sorry, not from the experiment side.
Right. Yeah. Day one was the refer to crew. And then when we spun Unsplash out, there was definitely we understand that people as a behavior, if I want to use an image, I'm thinking about Unsplash. That's starting to happen. That's the first step. It's like, I think a lot of people building products, you sometimes get that backwards, right? Like you're thinking about all these things. You're thinking about how to charge, how to optimize. You first need to change behavior for people. People are doing one thing and that's an alternative to your thing. So we spend a lot of time on making sure that that was like greased up and working really well. And then, yeah, our mind shifted to what is the model behind this. One of the first ideas we did have was including brands on it. It wasn't in the full-fledged form the way that we speak about it today. That's really been honed in from actually talking to these brands. And I think what happens sometimes with platforms is they're usually started by builders who like this new behavior and creating a new product. And then if it is big enough to support advertising, those same builders are usually not interested in advertising.
Yeah.
And we weren't interested necessarily in advertising in the typical way, but I think what we found is Unsplash's model is unique and that excites us. It's something that's innovating another industry that really sucks. Like advertising sucks, like the stock image world, that was all cheesy. And so like these two industries, we're excited about changing those two. So we were interested and ourselves to change advertising. And that was part of, I think, was important. It needed to be interesting to us, but the other, it had to align with the mission. So how could we keep the images open and accessible? That meant not like charging for images. So we took that one off the table. And then the third was like, how do we think about this from what's going to a strategic perspective? Like, where is this market going? And all the combination of those three is really what the output was, the advertising model.
And just to clarify and paint a picture for people who haven't seen the way your advertising works, it's not just like a typical banner ad style or programmatic or even a auction
right.
style that people are used to on Google and Facebook. So is it more of a brand? Because I work in marketing as well. And if you're a brand, you normally have two buckets of money. One is, and I'm simplifying, but just to simplify here, you've got brand dollars and then direct response dollars, right? Like people want to click through and sign up for an app. So I'm assuming you're going more after the brand dollars here. Is that right?
Yeah. So we didn't want to set something up where you're competing directly against Facebook and Google. We also just as an ethos, just don't believe in that style. From the brand side, Unsplash is really good at that because we can get you everywhere and people seeing you. So we can drive a lot of awareness. Like in a month, we reach 300 million people and it's in places that can't typically reach with any other advertising. Like where the Unsplash images end up sitting, they're in the actual content where people are actually paying attention.
Love it.
So we actually, a lot of what we speak about sometimes internally is that we're more of like a real estate company. So there's real estate all over the internet and most of the advertising sits in like the really shitty spots on the outskirts.
Yeah.
And we've all stopped paying attention to it. Where the Unsplash visuals typically are is in the actual content. And so it's much more, people are paying much more attention to it. It comes with headlines that are usually related because the keywords that they're using to rank the visuals on Unsplash, they put them on the tops of those. that's where they're paying. And then the ideal is the creators are coming and they're saying, hey, that visual of that brand is going to be really useful in my blog post. So for example, we work with Microsoft. And if you're work from home, you're writing something on work from home, you search work from home, you're going to see people work from home and it's going to be on Microsoft computers. And if that's a useful image and you decide that, you put it in your post, that's great for Microsoft. That's great for you as a creator. That's what we really like about this model of how it's good for everybody.
No, that's brilliant. I'm thinking of it from a traditional marketing standpoint. It's kind of a mix of like native advertising in the newer world and like product placement almost, like elements of product placement that you'd see a TV show and you're like, why is there... You don't even notice that there's a Starbucks mug on the friend's couch or whatever. But you're doing it in a way that it's already going to hundreds of millions of people, or and you're able to do it in a way that's useful rather than just in your face.
That's right. Yeah.
So I'd love to go into that like flywheel there. So you've got, you know, you've got the platform itself, which is you guys, and then you've got the people uploading photos or being approved to get photos on the platform. Then you've got brands nowadays as well. And then you've also got users like me going and downloading stuff for free. Is there anything else a part of that that I'm missing?
Yeah, the way we think about it is library discovery distribution. And so when you have the library is the images being submitted by all the contributors, if you make those more discoverable, if the search is better, that goes to distribution, that drives more distribution. The API also factors into distribution. So getting them inside of those integrations, inside of medium.com and all those places. And when you drive those image downloads, image views, that results in more opportunities for the contributors, which again increases the chances of more them submitting more images. So that just keeps driving that flywheel around and around.
I think there's two parts we can go into in a second. One is like the product design, and you mentioned like search working better and stuff like that, but also kind of partnerships. And like you mentioned API, so we'll come to that in a second. But let's start with the product side, because it feels like that's really been your focus on the growth side, is making the experience as good as it possibly can be and making sure the best content is available. So you mentioned like removing friction to gain traction. So this is a general concept people think about at a high level, but how does that look like in practice for you? Do you have any examples of things that you tested and changed that resulted in a positive outcome?
For us, the process starts working backwards. So we always look at what is the person who's going to use this going to see? And is that going to be useful to them? And then we work at, okay, how do we actually get there in the simplest way? How do we get that to them in the simplest way possible? So if we looked at Unsplash.com as an example, the original version, really all you want is a good image that you know you can use. Okay, so ideally, that's just sitting on your desktop. So it's like, how do you make a mechanism that makes that happen in the minimum number of steps as possible? So that means no logins. That means don't make me choose stuff like no sizes, no licenses. And that's really where we ended up. So it was, you end up on a page and you take the image off the page. And it seems simplistic in hindsight, but nobody did that. And it's because there's ulterior like incentives and motivations that get in the way. You're thinking about some other things too much. That's why we think about the sequencing a lot of like, you need a behavior change first before you can think about any of this other stuff. And that's why people who will keep logins is one of the easiest ways. We've always looked at that, like just remove the login. And a lot of people will come because they don't have to sit there and enter their passwords, which is usually one of the most annoying things that, that you can do on the site when you're starting. And yeah, so we just removed all that stuff. And I think that's how we think about most things. It's like, how do you dwindle it down to that essence of something that is still differentiated, but you've removed all the steps? And then what is the simplest delivery mechanism to get them that thing?
And I think the login example is really interesting because a clear goal for many different teams, and it depends on the size of the startup, but like I've worked with startups who are less than 10 people and then let's say up to 100 people, but like VC back needs to hit certain numbers. And you'll just see the friction between a product team, the growth marketing team, the content team, and like I've literally run experiments where I'm working on paid acquisition, let's say, and then there'll be someone else who's like, well, why don't we just put a login screen here after 3 seconds and the numbers go up? And I'm like, yeah, but you're not speaking to every user. You know that that's not a good experience, but because the number went up, they think it's okay. So it's just like, I think the question I have is, as the founder or the person who's running the company, how do you make sure all those teams are aligned in making sure you're driving towards that same goal and not essentially manipulating the numbers to hit their goals?
I think one thing is to spend more time at the beginning on the positioning of the company, even internally. So I think a lot of companies are in a rush. They start, they feel they need to get money. Once every layer you add, you get people, you get money, you build more product. It's all like debt. It basically sits on top of you and creates these conditions that you feel you have to start to live up to. And that creates these new motivations. So at the start, if you take a lot of time to think through what are we and what are we not. So one of the things we defined was we are not a social network. I think that was very important for us. So once you define that, then you can share that with investors. You can share that with your team when growth people are signing up. If you don't have that thing to share, then people are going to go run off and assume they need to drive user numbers or, you know, certain things like that. And when investors talk to you, even when investors talk to us, they say, what's your user numbers? And we don't say, we don't look at that. And that's like, sometimes for them, it's like, they're so used to that. But if you speak through the philosophy of what you care about and why, they can opt in to being inside of your company under the way that you're looking at it. So I think, yeah, just spending a lot more time of how you want to position the company, what you are and what you're not, will help solve a lot of those friction points that can happen down the road. It's not to say that you don't do that at some point when it makes sense. So we look at sequencing all the time as how we think about things. So right now, advertising is the model that makes sense because we're still trying to expand the number of people who can come to Unsplash and not get in the way of any of that. But there might be some opportunities later to monetize other things.
I've heard you mention, you kind of said it there, but like building in sequence, not in parallel, because a lot of the time people are doing many things at once. And it's also the problem with that is you often don't know what is impacting. It's harder to attribute value to what's actually happening. But if you're doing it in a sequence, you're able to focus in on one thing at a time. Just one last question on the product design side. Are there things that you tested that you thought might have an outcome that surprised you, whether positively or negatively? And it's fine if it doesn't, but curious if anything stands out.
Yeah, we introduced the option to log in if you wanted to. We didn't take away from the core experience at all. So like downloading images. This is when we were in discovery of like, are we a social network? Like we weren't sure. Are we a search engine or social network, hybrid? So there was a following feed, similar things to the dynamics of what you might find on Twitter. And it wasn't really being used by a lot of people. You know, it's being used by photographers, but represented like 1% of the entire audience. And it's taking up a lot of real estate inside of the product. So those were some of the decisions that we made and ultimately decided to scrap.
The last question I have on that is around measurement. So is this something you're setting up like A/B tests?
Yeah, our first hypothesis is usually what we think is our best guess. So we won't pick two. You know, we'll say, we think it's this. And we'll try it and see what the behavior is. Usually we'll err on the side of, this is definitely not going to mess anything up. You know, we'll put the login way over here. But usually it just comes from our intuition. And I think that's super important. I would never make something that I'm not a user of. And because it helps you with these decisions. Where would you want the login? Where wouldn't you mind it? You know, you don't have to go and talk to all these people to understand it. And even if you're doing that, that's kind of like a data point. It factors in potentially, but you have your own intuition of what you want to see in this product because you're the user. And ideally, you've collected through your experiences, things that you're reading, the people you're talking to, you've honed your own intuition of what this should be. And you can deliver something that people didn't expect that they would want.
I think the challenge is as you scale and you get more people and you're not in those decisions every day or every week, it becomes harder to kind of scale that intuition. And I guess it comes down to like hiring people who you feel have that same intuition or training for that as well. So maybe we'll jump into a little bit of that later. A question I have around the last thing on products is, you've talked to me previously when we spoke about multiple wow moments. So you said that you need multiple wow moments, not just one, to get people to switch to your product. And just the one kind of concept I'll share is, in the traditional advertising world, there's this rule of seven, which I don't necessarily completely agree with, but the rule is essentially people need to see your brand seven times at least just to notice you. So using that sort of concept, but on a product side, I see some parallels there in this wow moment. So like, what did you mean by that and why is that so important?
Yeah, behavior change is really difficult. You know, there's a common saying, you need a 10x better product in order to get people to switch. There's actually some research behind that. I believe it actually, some people did that, and it needs to be like 9.6x better.
All right.
And each wow moment is almost like a doubling factor. It's like, okay, this is a 2x better thing, but 2x won't get people to switch. And I think that's a trap that people often see. If you're really close to your own product and you've been working on it for a while and you know it's better, there's a lot of products that are better out there that people don't use. And because there's still a gap, there's a gap between that, you know, there may be at a 2x, they're not yet at like a 9x or a 10x difference. So it's this drastic change relative to what people are doing. So when I'm talking to people who are starting companies, I often ask, like, what is the current alternative? What does it look like? Because I'm trying to understand, relative to that, is your thing potentially 10x better? Now, it doesn't have to be 10x better right away, but you might have the path or the plan to eventually get there. And you saw this in many use cases. It's the thing, that's what creates that pull. Mm. You know, people just start using it all the time. Uber had a bit of that. There was just definitely a 10x better than using a taxi, right? Like, put it in your phone, you can track people. These are all like wow moments that sort of add up.
So let's go into last part of your kind of flywheel and growth. So I guess the way I'd like to frame this is, if you were doing an 80-20 analysis of like what drove your growth, I'm sure there's multiple factors, but what would you say was the 20% that drove the 80% of growth?
That product. So first having that product that people really loved, you know, and having it with 10 images, I think people, so there was sites that had images for free when Unsplash existed. You know, you had mentioned there, and I'd seen them and I'd tried to find stuff. It was just really difficult. Like, you could go to Creative Commons, do like a deep search, you go in Flickr, you do all this filtering stuff, and then you still end up with something that you don't quite know if you can use it or not. Mm. And so I think just making that super clear, even if it was only on 10 images, that delivery mechanism, because it was so clear, made people first themselves come back, then they told people about it, so it expanded from there. And then how it really scaled from there was SEO started to take off. So that was a strategy that we laid on top of this. But if you had SEO on top of a bad product, I don't think it would do the same thing, because SEO is attributing value to pages essentially that people see that are valuable. So you have to, at an underlying level, if you want your SEO to be really successful, you have to have a quality product that sits in the bottom architecture.
You know, if you did all the SEO in the world, which I know some of your early competitors did, people were scraping your site and just beating you on SEO because maybe they're like hacking their SEO better than you would have done early days. But they would have got to the site and it wouldn't have continued that spread where people like me were telling people, hey, if you need images, just like use this site, you're not going to get in trouble.
Yeah,
so that's really interesting. And then the other thing I mentioned before were partnerships. And think of this as like, there's the API part, which is you guys build an API that people can plug into. So if you're using, I think you said Medium, Notion, Coda, a bunch of different companies that I've, products I use that I just see you plugged in. I'm assuming that's all from the API. Did you guys ever do like hands-on partnerships too?
Yeah, our API started that way. So we just said we should make this open. People are using images individually, and there's a lot of requests for people who want to use them en masse. They're like building apps. Somebody wanted to make a puzzle using Unsplash images, a puzzle app. So we wanted to make that possible. And originally, yeah, it was like self-serve. And then once the deeper strategy started to happen, when we understood distribution was going to be the unique thing that Unsplash can do, that's when we were more intentional about bringing on some of the larger companies as well. But we had this beautiful like grassroots plus going to the big companies. And then over time, because we were working with all the grassroots, like it was just direct engineers, they all ended up at these companies. Mm. And then the creators ended up at these companies too, and they would push it through. So very similar to sort of that Stripe mechanism, you know, how Stripe really grew largely working with independent devs in the beginning, and then it just blew up from there.
The last kind of question on Unsplash is like, where's this going, man? I know you've got like a big vision for this by this point. It's not just a Tumblr blog anymore. So like, where do you see this company going over the next 10 years or so?
Everybody who's coming to Unsplash is trying to make something happen. And I think Unsplash is just a fundamental building block. It's like something that people can insert into their presentations. They can insert it into talks that they're giving to change minds, to move things forward. And I think that's super powerful. So for us, we want to be that default, like the de facto place where you could find any kind of visual that you want to be using. And in the ideal world, it's like every image is accessible and you're able to get them from Unsplash, you're able to get them inside of the places where you create. And it sort of creates this infrastructure, you know, image infrastructure layer for the internet. Mm. And that's really where we see it. But the whole goal is to enable more people to create, because we all have that creative spirit inside of us. And I think it's really being opened up now. The tools are getting so much better and more accessible, easy to use.
I love that, man. You perfectly segued us into the second part of the show, which is all about business philosophy. You just mentioned there, you know, all these new tools that are emerging that allow anyone to just go and create a website. And even more than that nowadays, there's a lot of no-code tools that are out there that allow you to create really complex things. You told me before that most internet businesses could be started without writing a line of code, you think. Could you just expand on that thought a little bit more?
I think we've abstracted away a lot of layers, you know, with certain services that you can combine together to connect people. So really most internet services, that's what you're doing at the end of the day, you're connecting people. And yes, there are some outliers to that, like independent games, which require some different things. But I think if you're in the business of connecting people in some way, you can start most of that without writing a line of code. Unsplash started that way. Crew started that way. You think of some other companies like Airbnb. A lot of these companies in the early stages, they didn't have much to write home about from a code perspective, but they did some of that manually. You know, they'd like for us, one of the a little anecdote from Crew, we didn't have any mechanism for like when we'd have designers come in and projects come in. So we would actually create Gmail accounts, and we wanted to, because we kind of keep it anonymous. So every project had its own Gmail account. So it was like project1+crew@gmail.com. All of the potential people who wanted to work on that project would come into that inbox. Mm. We'd give the business the access to that inbox. And then we used Woofoo as the sign up form. And we had, you can make 5 for free. So we would make these new accounts to like get the 5 free forms every single time to create what you wanted to do for your project. So you could stitch together all these things. And we used MailChimp to send out in a newsletter all the gigs. So it was literally through those 3 things. And combining that, we didn't have to write any code. We were able to get to $25,000 in project flow on that.
I'm assuming you meant that in 2021, there's so many more of those tools available that...
Yeah, it's even better.
That you can actually just hack something together like you did. I guess, though, you get to a certain point where, you know, to create an Unsplash the way you have, where your product is so much better than before. And I love the way you described earlier about like filtering and then still not knowing, because that's exactly how I felt. That is where you probably do require a little bit more custom coding or custom design, at least. I'm assuming you meant you can start something without these tools, but eventually you're going to need to get more custom. Is that how you feel about it or not really?
Yeah, once it starts scaling. And so that should be the determining factor. Like, I think you could validate pretty much most ideas to some level of scale without writing a line of code. So that way you don't have this extra, you know, overhead that you've probably put on top of yourself. you get to this level and demand should be pushing you to build the next thing. Like, that's how we thought about all of this stuff. Like, Unsplash was on Tumblr until it was annoying to scroll through 300 images. Like, enough people wrote to us and they're like, this is really annoying. We need a search box.
That actually brings up the kind of next concept around the value of ideas versus execution. And this is something I've thought quite a lot about too. You told me that good ideas are undervalued relative to execution. And I just for context, I think for a long time, people, the general public, thought that ideas were just all that mattered in a business. Like, oh, I'm going to have this genius idea one day and I'm going to become a millionaire or a billionaire. And then I think the business world kind of rebelled against that concept and said, well, actually,
yep.
Well, everyone has ideas. It's the execution that counts. And now I'm sensing, I think I'm in the same boat as you, which is there's a part to take from both of them, which is now we're seeing the counter trend, which is, yeah, you still need a good idea. Like, a terrible idea, perfectly executed, is still probably not going to work. So I'm curious, like, your thoughts on that. Like, how important is an idea versus execution?
Yeah, the right idea changes everything. Like, it makes execution easier. It makes hiring easier. It makes PR easier. You could screw everything up. Like, you think of that first year with Unsplash. We essentially did the opposite of what you're supposed to do to build a business, and it still grew. And that's because the idea, and yes, there was a level of execution at the beginning, but what I mean by an idea is you have that idea of what should exist, kind of that first version. And that, if that's the right thing, that wave is just really powerful and can solve all the other problems that happen in business building. It just makes up for so much. And I think what you were saying, that's what I feel, that the pendulum has swung. I hear a lot of people just like, you hear the stories, survivorship bias, you know, you made it 10 years and look at them, you know. But there's a lot of people just hacking away at ideas that, if a lot of us looked at that idea, you're like, it's not going to work. Like, there might be an evolution of it, but what you want it to be, it's probably not going to be that. And so you're spinning your wheels essentially on something because the idea, original idea, is not differentiated enough.
I'm going to ask a honest question. Did you feel like that with your last company, like the one that you sold?
Yeah, I think one of the things that you fall into is you're always, it's right around the corner. You know, the next wow moment, you're about to build it and we just need to get there. And I had that inside of me. You know, I had thought a lot about, we're going to get there. We just need to keep building. And one of my co-founders pointed it out to me. He's like, I believe you. And every time we have these conversations, I believe this. I think, but this moment, we should maybe reflect on this and let's see, does this stuff move the needle? Let's put a stake in the ground 6 months from now. And did it actually change things? And so when we got to that moment and there was not a material change, that was a moment for me where you sort of like the Kool-Aid kind of wore off a little bit and you're like, wait, were we not quite as close as we thought we were? I still believe there was things there, but it was going to be a long road and there was a realization moment that happened there. And we still do that tactic today. Whenever there's something that's uncertain that we're deciding to work on, we'll put that stake in the ground and say at you know, this time we think it's going to be this 3 months later, and then we'll put it in the calendar and then that date pops up and we wrote that 3 months ago. So we see how far off were we, how right were we, how wrong were we.
Yeah, that's a tough balance to strike, right? Knowing intuitively when the right time to stop is versus keep going, because a prerequisite for entrepreneurship is that you keep going when things look bad essentially and they're not working and you figure it out, right? But beyond the cliche, there are times, like you said, where you're like, actually, this one isn't working. I'm just going to keep going in another direction. I don't know if that's something you can learn or at least look out for. Is that something you've thought a bit about?
Yeah, I think taking breaks off from the day-to-day is good for that. You probably need at least a week or 10 days to pull yourself out. You know, writing investor updates are sometimes moments for people to have those reflections. Having people around you, thoughtful people, so like my co-founders in that case, created those moments. So there's those moments that are there, and then I think being intentional, asking yourself in that moment, am I fooling myself, might be a good just exercise to think through, and maybe you're not. Maybe you do have a plan to eventually get there. I think we did have a unique case where we had Unsplash sitting right next to it. So it's like, I always look at this example of like, we've got two blackjack hands, you know, one is 20 and one is 16. If you had to choose, you're going to go with the one that's 20. It's not that I don't think it's possible on this one. It's still possible, but there's a better opportunity that sits here. And yeah, I agree with the philosophy of, if you believe, you don't give up. If you care, you don't give up. Like, sometimes people just really care about a business idea. I'm talking more about, your goal is to make a big profitable business, then you should be looking at that viability of that business, of the idea. But if your thing is like, I need this mission and this needs to exist in the world, I think there's a different reason why you're starting it. And so I've never really given up on creating a great business, because that's been my driver, has been creating a great business that a lot of people can find value from.
Yeah, thanks for sharing, because I think that's one of those things that often gets talked about in cliches, and it's a very black and white thing, like, no, just keep going, no, you're stupid, you know, and it's like,
yeah.
And it's a really difficult thing. And I think when people, who I'm sure many people listening to this have felt this, it's really a mental thing. It's a thing of like, where, and it's like self-doubt, and sometimes you get down and depressed about it, and you're like, well, mate, you start doubting yourself. And those are things you need to work on, but also sometimes you're not in the right thing. So just one last thing on the company side, I think as you've started to scale and you've got 25 people, you said, or 26 people, you've started to, you know, transition as a CEO, as really your job is to hire great people, set the vision, make sure there's money in the bank, as I've heard it described. So I'd love to go into like how you recruit key people, because you mentioned that there are superpowers in the next 10 years for recruiting, that if you can operate a distributed team effectively and you can identify undiscovered talent. So I'd love to go into both of those separately. So what are you looking for in the way that you are hiring, and how does that tie in with a distributed team as we look in, with a 10-year horizon?
The first criteria is talent. So I don't care where you went to school, don't care about resumes. I'm really looking at work product. So there's filters in my head. I know kind of some positions that we're hiring for that are interesting for us. But then if I just come across somebody interesting, we'll probably try to find a way to work with them.
Mm.
And this is through networks. So we largely don't use the same filtering mechanisms that like a Google or Facebook would do when they're trying to find people. I'm looking at how you think on Twitter. I shared with one of my friends, he's like, you know, looking for engineers, and I had like a simple philosophy on it. I was like, if read Stratechery, which is like a strategic tech blog, plus engineer, hire, you know, because you've got a unique combination of thinking and skill that could be great as an engineer in the company. And that's not the same filtering that like Google's recruiting team is not using that if then statement.
Yeah, definitely not.
So you have like an arbitrage opportunity on talent just by looking at talent differently. And so that's the focus there. And then distributed, if you bring people in from different places, can you operate well? You know, once they're inside of the company, some people can only operate teams that are local, right? They have to be in the building. They have to be in that sort of way. But I think the future is going to be more distributed, not necessarily like fully distributed in all cases. I still do see benefits of seeing people in person. But if you have that power, that ability to operate a distributed team effectively, and you can find this undiscovered talent, that's like a 10x, you know, in sort of both ways. You just have so many people that you can bring into your company, and then you know how to operate it effectively, bringing everybody together.
How do you test for that, like the distributed part? Because a lot of the time you don't really know that properly until they join the company. So even if they've worked previously somewhere that was distributed, and of course you can ask references and stuff like that, I just find references not really that honest most of the time, because the references they give are normally people that like them. So how have you tried to filter out people like that?
So we'll do references, but we'll do our own. We won't ask them for references. I'll find random connections that might know something about that. But when it comes to like being able to work effectively distributed, we'll largely try to create a condition, like an initial project, something that we can do together just to see that flow. You can usually see it through interviews because we're distributed. So how do you set up, are you on the video? Are you not? Are you calling with your phone? There's different little things that we notice there. How you're communicating through the email when we're asking questions. Those are little things that we pick up on, but we largely take it upon ourselves to have a good product. So it's sort of the, if someone's using a bad product and they get confused by it, is it the person's fault or is it the product's fault? I always try to say that it's the product's fault. So we will try to optimize the product to the max so that any smart person coming in, even if they don't have a ton of distributed background, we've built a great product.
No, that's, I love the ownership of that there. I really loved your example of the newsletter plus, engineer. I'm curious, like for other functions, within the company, where are there other examples like that, that you're looking out there for undiscovered talent? So maybe I can just throw a few out there, like a marketing hire versus a sales hire.
Yeah, Twitter would be big for marketing. Twitter to me is like the proper LinkedIn.
Yeah.
It's like what LinkedIn wants to be but can't. And it's really where a lot of business is being done today. And if you're capable of being on that network, that's very interesting to me. And then from a sales perspective, that's a bit harder sometimes because salespeople are good at selling, right? So I almost look at like who could sell me really, really well, even if in the end, I didn't expect, that kind of tactic, but you were really good at it. So I'll look at those things, but what we've seen from each one, we've developed, I think, good criteria from experience of someone that can be successful. So from a sales perspective, what we've really learned for the kind of sales that we need, advertising sales to big brands, having relationships is really important. So if we had an 80-20 pie on that, 80% is relationships, because that's also solving other things. So if you are able to keep good relationships, it probably means a lot of other things. You can probably sell well, you can probably speak well, you can pitch well. If you're able to maintain relationships, it's likely a leading indicator of a lot of other things.
Yeah, it's a certain type of person who even has the foresight it's not even foresight sometimes, it's just more like the natural want to do that.
Yeah.
Right, and I think a salesperson, I've been a salesperson in the past, you kind of have to just like talking to people, and you constantly are staying in touch with people just because you like doing that. And obviously there's different types of salespeople, but just generalizing, that's really helpful. I've also heard you talk about the superpower org chart, which I haven't heard this before. So I've heard you talking about this, it creating optimal leverage in the company. So what, first of all, what is a superpower org chart and how does that make your company more effective?
Yeah, when we started like organizing the company, it was sometimes helpful to know, where people are working. And this is where like the org chart comes up. And I didn't necessarily like making org charts. But one way I thought that was really interesting is when I looked at the org chart, usually you're seeing people's skills put into buckets. So they work in like development or design, and that's basically their skill, and they sit over there in the org chart. I started to break it down by person based on, here's what I know that they're really, really good at and what they like to do. And here's a bunch of stuff that's in this job that's still kind of in their way. So when I look at the org chart now, I see the names, but then I see what's their superpower under that and what's currently in the way of that. And every person has that. And so my job as a major recruiter in the company is to figure out, can I get rid of this stuff that's in your way so you can just be doing your superpower? How do I remove that? And constantly looking at this org chart and evolving it. So I take these pieces that are in the way of these people, those become roles. Now, who has a superpower that we can maybe hire, or who's somebody in the company that already has a superpower of doing that, that becomes part of them. And so you're just, think of that magnification. If you're doing that across 25 people in our case, in other companies, 500 people. Mm. Imagine you created that sort of leverage where previously maybe half the time someone was doing stuff that they're not optimal at, but the other half they're super good, rare, you know, like 10x better than anybody else. And now you just doubled that time that they could do that 10x activity. That's a huge change in impact that you can make in the company. Probably the biggest form of leverage, you know, the people make the company, right? So this is the largest thing that you can do.
I love that idea of just the superpower and the blocker. Are there a few one or two examples of what you've actually done, like a role that someone was in, their superpower, and how you got rid of that blocker?
Yeah, so even one for me, you know, at the beginning was I was still doing some of the marketing stuff, and it was useful, but it wasn't the biggest point of leverage. And it's something I like doing, but it wasn't the biggest point of leverage for my skill set in the company at the time. So that's when we opened up a marketing hire. I still took some of my time to hire that person. But once that person was in, I felt this great opening. You know, it's like I was flying. I was able to fill that in with some very high leverage activities at the time.
And just to clarify, what would you say is your main superpower if you were writing it on your org chart?
Yeah, I think the way that I think about it is a lot of the communication and marketing, but in high leverage activities that are very unclear. So for example, if we need to go 0 to 1 with our advertising product, that's something that I stepped in at, because that was one of my superpowers. How do we define this? Essentially a new product, and how do we communicate it, and how do we get it out?
In the conversation with Andrew Wilkinson, we talked about the four types of entrepreneurs or creators. I can't remember all of them off the top of my head, but there's like essentially the starter, the 0 to 1 person, there's the scaler, there's the remixer, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like I'm assuming you're the 0 to 1 type, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that best defines me of those.
That's the part that gives you the most energy, the most satisfaction.
Yeah. And I think it's the part that I've seen where it seems I have a unique ability there. From the results that have been produced, I have some sort of track record of being able to do that.
Well, listen, we're going to move into the last section now, which is kind of like the quick fire-ish behind the mind section. So it's quick fire in a way, but we can discuss if anything really resonates. So the first one is really around life design philosophy. So I know this is something you're really interested in, and you've really optimized your own life towards certain things that you mentioned designing a life that could compete with a dream vacation. So I'm curious, like, what does that mean to you, and how are you being more purposeful in doing that?
The whole starting of the internet company was largely around freedom. You know, I felt, you know, I had some tastes of working in jobs, and I was like, this is it forever. You know, I couldn't do it. And the other thing I felt in university, when I was looking at things, they would give you a sheet of like potential salary ranges for each job. And I'm like, how is there a cap on all of it? Like everything is just capped. So what if I'm better than that? Like I can't be, I just am capped. And I just didn't like how that felt. And I felt that there had to be something different. So largely it started from that path of freedom. And I think a lot of people who are starting companies and businesses, they're looking to do something like that. But the way you create your business is sort of the second way of sticking to that original ideal. I think once you get in the business, sometimes it takes over you, right? And you read how to build a business, you do all these things, and you start following how other people have done it, but it's not necessarily the way that you want to run the business. So I feel fortunate in the sense of, with Unsplash, we fell into a kind of business which fits the way that I want to be building and that our team wants to be building. Like, we can work distributed. There's a lot of companies who just can't. They have like logistics, they have different things. So some companies are heavy infrastructure, you know, so in a way I'm fortunate, or supply chain, you know, there's these other components that are parts of other companies that Unsplash doesn't necessarily have, that fits perfect with how we want to run the business and fits with the lifestyle design that we're aiming to create, which is like, we don't have set hours, we work. I really believe that there's a creative flow to how everybody works, and it's individualized. And when you try to force people to do certain things, it never ends well. You're going to rebel. You're going to feel tired in that moment. So we've always worked on the company in that way. And you can't do that in all cases. But we've done that since the beginning. And then when we have investors or people, I think some people are afraid too. If you've got investors, can you work in this way? Can you do these things? I think just telling people how you work, and also people aren't going to mess with the way you work if it's working, right? If you have investors, that means you're probably doing something good. If you have revenue, you know, whatever you're doing is working. It's not some set single philosophy of a way to build a business.
That really resonated with me where you just described the cap. And it's not even just the money. And I don't, first of all, I'd like to say, I think jobs are great. Like, I've had jobs that I've loved, and maybe I will again in the future. So I'm not against jobs, but there's a certain type of person, and I think I'm in the same bucket, which is, it just, that is a 20% in my brain just doesn't compute. And it just, I will constantly not feel satisfied in that situation because I know, okay, there's a cap on what I can do here on my own. And that part of that is money, but a part of that is really just not feeling completely valued, or you're not reaching your full potential, I guess, is the better way of putting it.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue is someone else put that on you.
Yeah.
Right. So like, I don't really care if I make less if I made myself make less.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, completely.
I think the issue is that someone else made that number and they're putting a cap on you. And that's what I think I've got a big issue with.
No, I love it, man. I feel like this is bringing up some like deep rooted experiences from childhood or something. You know, it's like, I mean, I definitely have that where I was like, I'm going to win the game. And like, you don't even get to participate. And you're like, well, F those people, I'm going to prove them wrong. And then later in life, that resentment can turn into a positive emotion. But for many years, it's not that. So yeah, thanks for sharing that, man. The next question I had was really around staying healthy while building a company. I know this is something you've been very conscious about, and it's something many people struggle with. I'd say probably 50% more of people really struggle with doing this. And obviously, people struggle with this across the board, but specifically when you're starting a company, you're working at crazy hours, you don't always have one routine, you have lots of emergencies. So I'm curious, like, how have you managed to kind of optimize for that and make it a non-negotiable?
So I think in the beginning, when you're really trying to figure stuff out and it just doesn't feel like you have a lot of runway to make something work, I think that's the hardest moment. And in that moment, trying to incorporate it into your everyday is probably the easiest. So we lived in my wife's parents' basement, and then you had the option of taking a 40-minute metro, or you could bike, which nobody does. So we would bike that. It was, I think, 5 miles in and then 5 miles back. And so having that already is something that you're building in. And then there's behavior changes. I think it's just, it's the intentional piece. It's cool. It might take me 20, 30 minutes longer to get back. But what if I can sustain working at a very, very high level for much, much longer than other people because I don't give up, because my physical body doesn't give up, which fuels my mental capacity at the same time. And I think all those things are related. So when your physical body starts to fail, you start to feel tired, your brain gets affected. The number one reason why companies fail is people give up. So if you can control one of the factors of that, you're increasing your outcomes as the business. That might cost you some upfront time. And I think, in the beginning, just trying to work it into your existing systems is probably the easiest way. But right now, we've built it into the company. So we have a workout with the team We do it, you know, during the day. So we do it during a time, like a lot of companies will put that after, right? So it's like, you got to work and then you got to do this work thing after all the time. And people don't really like that. But one of the reasons we put this during the day is to also encourage that you do not need to be working 9 to 5. It's another part of the company design of encouraging, don't work the hours that society expects you to work. Work the hours that your creativity wants you to work. And then we've supplemented that with, here's a body refresher that's part of this. We actually even have a stretching room, you know, with some stuff in there. And so it's part of the, yeah. And coming from people who've been in the company for a while, then everybody in the company starts to see that, and it starts to spread as like, oh, this is just part of the culture.
I was talking about this recently about a different context, but like kids at school, we feed kids like terrible food. I mean, including us growing up, I can speak for myself anyway. And like every day we're given like dessert with our food and like basically a bunch of refined carbs that spiked my sugar. And I was probably running around the playground and not concentrating, partly because of that as well. Changing, you know, the nutrition levels of a young growing person would make a huge difference to society, I'm sure. But I think we get into that dogmatic, almost like religion-like or political space where people start arguing about it and saying, this is right, don't force me to do it. But I like the way you've taken the approach, which is it's a gentle nudge. Like we're showing you, we're not just telling you, we're showing you. We're actually allowing, you're basically being paid right now, and we're giving you the room to do this. I think that's a much better approach.
Yeah, and I think when you see the leaders in the company, and leaders meaning people who've been around the longest, people will gravitate to those behaviors. So it really needs to come from that. That's much more effective than any email blast that you could send out or posters on the wall. And that's how we treat everything. Like it really just comes from us.
I've also, you also told me that you think inbox zero is a waste of time. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. This might rile some people up on the internet, but I love that. So what is your take on inbox zero?
Yeah, you have finite energy, right? So if you're spending that energy with the goal of removing your inbox, which for most people, probably at least 50% of it is garbage, you're taking 50% of that time and energy and putting it on garbage. So I get that it might help you find, if you have inbox zero, you might find better opportunities in your inbox easier. But I've created systems where I don't miss, you know, the good emails. And I see bubbles. My wife always says, she's like, looks at my phone sometimes and I have like 147 bubble, you know, or like even like a 560 bubble. She's like, how do you sit there with it? And it literally just doesn't enter my brain at all because I have that filter. Like I have no desire to remove those images those messages. If something is important enough that I maybe missed, maybe I'll miss one here or there, but for my sanity and then the ability to put that energy somewhere else, I'll take that little loss for the ability to create outbound. You know, so I think that is like an internal activity, right? Like you're in this and you feel like you're doing work a lot of the time, but value creation often happens from you going out versus going in.
You know, as an entrepreneur and someone who's leading a company, it might be very different to if your job is an account manager and your job is to respond to emails. Of course, the context matters, but even I've done that job in the past, and that even then there were systems I put in place that helped me be more proactive, because normally what happens is you just get 98% reactive because everyone's asking you to do something, and the people screaming the loudest get served first, unfortunately. Right. And that's not necessarily how you should be prioritizing in the first place. So yeah, I love that the way you described it as like proactive versus reactive. You mentioned systems there. You've put systems in place to make sure that something really important doesn't get missed. Could you go into a bit more detail what that looks like?
I think it's actually a visual system now. So I've tried a lot of things. I've tried the labeling. I've tried virtual assistant stuff. Really, it's come down to I can pick out now from email subject lines and names what's going to be important and little preview text.
Yeah.
So it's come down to that. It sounds simplistic, but everything else has just added layers of complexity and I have never really stuck to them properly. That's why I think when we talk about writing outreach emails, you know, there's a lot of stuff written about that. Why I think a lot of people actually filter their email like that.
Yeah.
So having, thinking through your subject line, that first sentence, how important that is. That's often why that comes up, I think, from a, if you're cold emailing perspective.
Yeah, I'm glad I made it through the inbox, man. We made it here. So. Well, I can't actually fully remember. I think we connected on Twitter first and then probably email, but that's probably a better, more authentic conversation. Like we met in the bar and now we met for lunch. It's a very different vibe. So it kind of leads into the next part, which was quite surprising, but I've heard this from a lot of people I respect recently. So I'm going to lean into it a bit with you. Text Edit is one of the greatest apps ever made.
Yes.
So like, tell me a little bit more about that.
So I only have this Zoom screen open and I have two Text Edit files open. I can never change this behavior. And I think it's because the thing is so simple, right? There's no delay when it loads. All these little details, like Text Edit is just that little plain text window that you can open on your computer. And if you shut off rich text editing, it's literally just a bunch of plain text with no formatting. And I find it gives me the most clear mind when I'm looking at like little notes or there's no delays. You know, I don't have to, is this going to sync? Where is it going to sync? If that gets messed up, is it iCloud? You know, this is terrible. To-dos, it always ends up going into Text Edit. So I shared something once where I'm like, if Text Edit was a company, you know, it would have to be one of the most valuable, like, because the amount of engagement that I've heard from a lot of people sitting in that one app that basically has no features it's astounding how much I use it relative to anything else.
I don't use Text Edit, but I respect it and I respect the concept. I had a Tim Urban on the show recently from Wait But Why, who's a great writer, and Polina from The Profile, who's also one of the best writers out there right now. And they both love, I mean, Tim Urban writes these huge posts and he used Text Edit and he has like four or five open at a time.
Yeah.
And we went into that process. And that's the thing. Look, there are some people who love new tools. I generally do like new tools and I play around with them. But I think the truth is they can become really distracting. And the 80-20 again of that is, what are the things that are distracting you? What can you get out of your brain that's distracting you from doing the work, right? Similarly, it kind of brings up the topic of like constraints. I've heard you mention that many times, and you've talked about working from your phone versus laptop, and you do your best writing on your phone versus being on a laptop. So I'm curious about that, because I do find myself doing that sometimes where I get in the zone, but I can obviously type a lot quicker on a laptop versus a phone. So go into that a little bit more.
Yeah, I find you're right. It's faster to write on a computer, but it's hard to get good ideas, right? I think that's the first part, right? You want to write something that's good. And I found, if you look at a lot of your text messages, you're probably like, that sounds really good. I like how that sounds. Why don't my blog posts sound like that? My blog posts sometimes sound like I'm writing a blog post, but I actually want the blog post to sound like I'm talking to a friend. So that's what I've done. So when I write our announcements or I do certain things, I'll usually start in the text message, or I'll start in a personal email to a person as if I was just telling them about it. And so it reduces it. You know, it really removes a lot of fluff. It removes a lot of layers that you're trying to live up to in a way. So I find the bigger the screen, this is also why I have a small screen phone. I find the bigger the screen, the more you fill it, right? It's like the space thing. If you have more space, you're going to fill it with more stuff. And it also increases the bar. You feel like you have to make something that's bigger, that's better. When really, when you tweet this after, most people will go the opposite way. They'll write the blog post, then they write the tweet. But usually the tweet is better than the blog post, and the tweet is probably the only thing that people read. So it's starting, yeah, backwards. Like, what are people going to read was where you should kind of start. And that's how I flipped that. And the phone just constrains it. It forces you to write really simply, like you're writing to a friend.
I love the way you actually start in the text message, because that's where you're most used to talking informally and in a way that people can actually receive that message.
Yeah.
You also are quite intentional about creating space in your calendar for unique things, whether that's DMing people or emailing interesting people. I'm curious, like, why you prioritize that, and like, what does that look like in practice?
Yeah, that's been one of the things that I think has impacted our small things that has impacted our company the most. So just messaging good people. So when you read something, you know, most people don't take the action of writing to the writer. You know, so what I do when I find something good, pretty much anything good, I'll try to find the person and write to them.
Yeah.
Just not with no ask, but just to say whatever they made was great. And that's the start of some potential relationship. Now, if you do this over and over, so I don't always hit it, but I have a slot Friday where I make time to do this. Sometimes I'll do it right away, you know, as I see something, because I know sometimes I don't follow up and do it. And then I sort of track it. I have mechanisms for being able to keep staying in touch with these people. So if at Twitter, you know, I'll follow them, I create a list. And what I'm trying to do is just stay in touch with really great people, because one, because it interests me. So I think it has to interest you. But this has become, this has evolved in some of the people who've been the best hires for the company, investment for the company, tons of partnerships, friends, all from this one little tiny activity.
This resonates so much. And I'm going to put a screen. If you're on YouTube, you'll see a tweet that I put out about basically proactive actions like DMs, cold emails, cold calls, turning up to an event. Like, these are things that have a disproportionate impact, like, just for me looking back on my life, turning up to an event when I almost went home, or sending a DM to someone just to say, oh, I love your work. Like Jack Butcher, who I've probably spoken to him more than anyone else on the internet in the last like 6 months. That came from me just sending a message saying, man, I love your work. And that was, I love this post. And I wasn't trying to get him on the podcast or anything. I was just like, I really love, someone took time to create something. And I think that comes from our background of being creative people as well, where you know what it took to create something. And when someone sends you a message to acknowledge it, it makes your day. And those things compound over time. So I'm definitely in the same boat with you there, man. And I love that you actually scheduled time to do it as well. I might try that out too.
Ours started that way too. And yours was, I liked something that you shared and then you wrote to me.
That's it.
So that's exactly it. Like, making those lines closer, because these relationships can just compound for life, and it's like the best thing.
I agree, man. Yeah, and what I like about that is there's no, you can see very quickly when someone's just trying to pitch you something, or get something out of you. And look, I'm not against people pitching either, right? Like, do your thing, but it helps so much more when you've just been doing this forever. Like, I, again, not to talk about myself the whole time, but I've looked back at some emails. There's a guy, Josh Buckley, who just became the head of Product Hunt, like the CEO of Product Hunt. And me and him spoke when I was like 18 and he was like 15.
Yeah.
And we've got these emails from 10 years ago. And I'm like, hey, let's jump on a Skype call. And we had these Skype calls and we were kids. And now 10 years later, or even longer, you know, he's doing incredible stuff. So it just, you don't know who those people are going to become. And if you just go into that situation just saying, anyone I'm speaking to, whether they're 15 years old or 72 years old, I could probably learn something from them.
Yep.
I just feel like you live a better life. So amen to that, man. Just to wrap us up here, we've got, you know, both of us, I feel like, are working from different angles within what is being called the creator economy, or the D2C creator economy, or the creator movement. Like, what does that world mean to you, and how do you feel like Unsplash will be a part of that in the long term?
Yeah, I love that world. So I think, you know, I have a daughter, she's 18 months old. You can see the creativity that we're all born with. We all have this. My mom was a teacher for 30 years. And you see it in kids, and then somewhere along the way, you know, it's getting beaten out of us, you know, whatever it is, like the creativity. And I think what's happening, because there's so much accessibility around the tools and the things that you can create with now, and the phone has done that because we can take that everywhere with us. The networks, being able to share things out in your creative spirit, there's another element to you can share stuff because now people will find it. And I think that's just super powerful for building markets, even like small markets for people to find each other. Like, that just is getting more and more possible every single year. Even like 5 years ago, it was still harder to have, you know, like a full gathering. Like, my brother makes clothes, for example. He sews them together. It's much harder 5 years ago for him than it is today. He's able to connect with people who are interested in that stuff much, much easier. And so I think that's just really powerful. And now you're starting, and we've talked about the D2C creator. It started as D2C brands. They could sort of leverage this. The costs had reduced enough for a brand to do it. Now the costs have reduced enough for an individual person to do it. And that's great, because now you can do exactly what you want to do. This kind of goes back to make the product that you would want to exist. We're seeing that all across the board, like people reviewing products that they like, they want. You probably have these conversations anyway, and you're turning that into a product. I turned something into a product that I wanted to exist. And because of the internet, we're able to reach all the people who are potentially interested in that thing. And so, yeah, everybody can fulfill their own creative thing. They don't have to make some warped version of it. They don't have to make amends. You know, they don't have to become this other thing because they need to reach more people to make that an actual business.
I think back to like Gary Vee's first book, or one of the first books about, he kind of talked a lot about, like, was it Crush It? I think it was around, you know, you've got like a Smurf like interest and you can make a blog on that, and one day you can make a living from that. And you know, I like Gary. I think he's a nice guy. I don't always agree with everything he says, but I think he definitely was on the money with that quite early on, and we're seeing that evolve so much in the last, even in the last year, how much is evolving. And I feel like a lot of people aren't realizing how much is going to continue to change, because they're looking at things as they are now, which is you can have a million views on a YouTube video and still, or even a million views on a YouTube video, not make much money from it. Yep. And my thought on that is, yeah, that's annoying if you spent time and energy and money to create something and you don't make much money from that. But maybe you're the future. You're the same. You should see that the way musicians did with streaming, because now you've got a million people that saw your stuff. Maybe the way you're monetizing was wrong, or needs to evolve at least. So if you've got real attention, you can monetize that. There's 100 ways to do that, and there will be even better ways to do that in the future.
Yeah, and I think social capital is getting more and more powerful because of all the connectivity and all the different platforms and the tools getting better, so you can share all of this stuff. If we looked at it like currency, I would put, like, if you looked at the graph of social capital growing as a currency and the power of that, I think that's getting more and more and more stronger. I've seen in the last couple of years, individual creators within 6 months, 12 months, life-changing, you know, things. And I didn't see that as much 5 years ago.
Yeah, man. Well, that's what this podcast is all about. And thank you so much for sharing an incredible example for people as well of what's working and how you've done it in so much detail. Where can we send people, man? Obviously, there's Unsplash, and you're at Mikkel Cho on Twitter, which we'll put on the screen and in the show notes as well. Is there any ask or anywhere we should send people?
No, that works then.
Well, listen, man, this has been incredible. Thanks for spending so much time. We've, like, the time's flown. We've been here almost 2 hours. So
it's great.
I hope you enjoyed it too. And yeah, looking forward to doing more together.
Yeah. Thanks, Bilal. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. I'll have an episode for you every week. These are raw, uncut, and actionable conversations with the greatest business minds and creators in the world. So make sure you're subscribed. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, BZAIDI, or CreatorLabFM on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.